Okay, my name is Martin Sanchez, or as some people know me, Martin Sanchez. In 2004, I became Consul General of Venezuela here in Chicago, and I stayed here for 4 years, and then I was sent to the West Coast, to San Francisco, where I stayed for 3 years. I'm now working back again in alternative media and doing software in the Bay Area and working with Venezuelan colleagues. So, you know, I've been around the block. And before that, I, in 1991, I became a Marxist as the Soviet Union was collapsing. And when I was in college in Venezuela, I was active in, supporting union strikes and the fight for budget in the university, public university where I attended. And so I came to the U.S. in 1994 and, finished college here in the U.S., active again in the student movement and active in the Teamster strike in the 90s with the UPS workers. And then in the year 2000, I campaigned for Ralph Nader. You might remember the election in which the Democrats say that Ralph Nader allowed George W. Bush to become president. I've been around the block. So I'm going to talk mostly about, there are so many things to talk about when it comes to the coup in Venezuela. And a lot of things that you hear have to do with high-level negotiations, what politicians did, what the media did. And, you know, I want to concentrate on what the people from below did to defeat this coup and what people keep doing to keep this project alive, what we're trying to do in Venezuela. So I first have to start by mentioning that the big wave of activism that we see in Venezuela predates the Chavez era. It comes from many, many years, especially in the 80s when Venezuela entered into economic depression. We had especially unions were very active, unions and students very active in protesting austerity measures and cuts in budgets and all that. So we have in 2009, the recently elected president enacted a 1989, I mean, that's wrong, not 2009, 1989. Yeah, that picture looks like Photoshop if it was really from 2009. I say we because I also participated in the riots. I looted some stores. I'm from a poor neighborhood in the western section of Caracas. Not a lot of people, you know, when they talk about this event, they romanticize the poor came. Well, I was the poor. I did loot supermarkets. So anyway, it was a rebellion against the austerity measures that the government had enacted on the mandates of the IMF. The IMF demanded that they cut the education budget, the subsidies to gasoline, to food, and all that. But they did that right away. All of a sudden, even before people got their paycheck at the end of February. So people took to the streets, and we have, a total of 2,000 people were murdered in those 3 days after the 27th. And so we have that, that represented actually the first rebellion, international rebellion against the IMF. There's no other, before that, there's no history of, a massive revolt against IMF measures. So Venezuela, in a sense, was a pioneer in that regard. So we have then, in fast forward 1992, we have Hugo Chavez attempted to overthrow the government at the time. The government was hated by the people, extremely corrupt. So Chavez fails, but he, becomes such a superstar in the political scene because he assumes his mistake of having failed and having an unsuccessful coup, and he didn't blame anybody else but, you know, himself. He assumed responsibility, something that in Venezuela we were not accustomed to seeing politicians assume responsibility for their actions. So here comes this guy who fails, but he says, yeah, I did it and I fail and it's all my fault. I'm sorry, but, you know, later we'll try it. For now, we had failed. So that "for now" phrase became, you know, well, for now, what do you mean? Is that you're planning something else? So we had all this, you know, hope. Well, the guy went to jail, but he said "for now," so maybe he has some project for the future. And it's true. Actually, we have, oh, look at the way that the media portrayed. I took this, especially this newspaper, because they mentioned a little child, little girl was killed during one of the shootings during the coup d'etat. So they mentioned like the most, you know, the thing that will hit people's heart the most, you know, because of the actions of this guy, this little girl died. And, you know, they tried in any way to portray Chavez in a bad way. By the way, that newspaper is owned by the family of the guy who's running against Chavez nowadays, Capriles. So that's the most widely read newspaper nowadays in Venezuela is owned by this guy. So, you know, if you look at the elections right now in Venezuela, who is Chavez facing? It's a media guy, basically. So we have then Chavez was pardoned by the next president. He gets out of jail and he went out on a grassroots campaign to run for president, and he runs on a platform to reform the constitution, call for a constitutional assembly and create a new constitution. So he wins the election, and there's a constitutional assembly, you know, a big democratic, you know, event, and everybody, and, you know, even the part of the bourgeoisie in Venezuela were like, well, you know, the old regime was so discredited, maybe this new guy who's acting democratically now, maybe we can trust him and maybe we can, you know, pull him towards, you know, our side of the camp, and you know, make him become business as usual. And you know, at that time I thought, well, you know, Chavez was not a socialist. He actually said that he sympathizes with some, you know, socialists. He went to Cuba, but it wasn't clear. He actually, his platform was a capitalism with a human face. What they called, used to be called the third way, the phrase that Tony Blair coined, that it's neither Washington nor Moscow. There's another way, but it's actually a capitalist exploitation way, but, you know, with a new face, not exploiting too hard, but just squeezing enough to not kill the workers, but, you know, squeezing the labor out of them. So Chavez actually did enjoy a media honeymoon because, you know, as I said, the bourgeoisie thought that they could actually, you know, tame this guy and make it conform to the rules, but he didn't. Actually, one very controversial thing that Chavez did that is related to my main thing, which is media, which is that he ended the subsidies that the newspapers enjoyed, the paper subsidies, because Venezuela imports about 60 or 70% of the paper pulp that newspapers use to print their newspapers. So having all this, you know, import stuff to do, the government in the 80s, in order to win favors from the media, they enacted this subsidy for the newspapers. So the government paid half or more than half of the cost of the paper. So basically, you know, corporate welfare, Ralph Nader would call it. So Chavez ended that. And that, of course, immediately won him a lot of enemies in the media. So the honeymoon was over when at the end of 2001, the media joined the Chamber of Commerce campaign that Kim described. To, you know, call for a strike at the end of December 2001. They struck for, I think it was 2 or 3 days, and it was a, you know, like a test to see who will join the strike. And the media campaign was so big that it made it into a somewhat successful thing. I remember I left Venezuela at that time, the day that the strike was going to start, and I was at the airport thinking, am I going to get out of here? And, well, American Airlines saved us because we were able to get on the plane and get out of there. But as you can see, in the media heated up the environment, all leading to April of 2002, in which they, you know, they led the campaign to call for a new strike and demand Chavez's resignation. Before that, something that I didn't put in the slides is that the leaders of the coup went to Washington in March to meet with State Department staff. And supposedly after the coup, the State Department issued a statement saying that, of course, they had nothing to do with the coup, that they told this Venezuelan military or civilian guys that they would not support a coup, that it's wrong, don't do it. Don't do it, it's wrong. So, but they went there, and so, you know, they basically got some support, at least, you know, from the U.S. There's no evidence that there was monetary support, but as Kim said, you know, the campaign against Chavez was a local campaign by the local bourgeoisie against a guy who would not enact policies that benefit their interests. So, of course, being Chavez being and at that time perceived as such an anti-corporate person, of course, international capital also will join the campaign against Chavez, and it would be in their interest to get rid of this troublemaker. So the media campaign was so big that they did manage to mobilize. Here we have, like, I don't know, I would say 100,000 people or 200,000 people that, you know, what the opposition said that they mobilized. This is people coming from the east side of Caracas, where wealthy people live. They mobilized sections of the bourgeoisie and the upper middle class, people who, you know, they saw Chavez enacting policies, you know, in benefit of the poor of the poor, and that took away, as I said, you know, the subsidies that the newspapers didn't enjoy. That money went to the poor barrios. So they saw this transfer of wealth away from, you know, from the privilege that they used to have from controlling the state, and they don't have this control anymore. So, of course, they mobilized. And there were all kinds of things, not only economic, because it's not like, you know, the middle class lost jobs or anything. The country was not in a big crisis. It's just ideological too. A lot of people would, and this mimics what happened in Chile in 1973. The media and the right wingers would tell people all kinds of things. Like, for instance, that Chavez is going to eliminate private schools, and all your kids will have to attend a public school where they will be taught about Marxism and Cuba and Fidel Castro and things like that. And some people did believe that. There were all kinds of crazy rumors that if you have two cars, then the government is going to expropriate one of your cars to give it to the poor. And they would have all this, and they would have opinion shows on TV in which they would say, yeah, we have internal information from the government that they plan to do this. And then a lot of people really believe that. I have relatives who really, now they are embarrassed because they believe that stuff back then. But it was so believable because you see people on TV with a suit and tie, you know, saying all this stuff. And, well, yeah, what if it's true? So that's why we have an exodus of people going to leave, Venezuelans going to live in Miami. And we still have about 200,000 people living there. You know, Miami is the city where corrupt Latin American politicians and the rich go retire and live. So anyway, they did manage, the media managed to have, you know, 24/7 coverage of anti-Chavez figures. They coordinated media appearances by military generals who were demanding the overthrow of Chavez. And the, as you know, because many of you who saw the revolution will not be televised, the footage of these people at this bridge who were defending themselves against police officers who were, you know, part of the coup plotters, they claim that these people kill opposition activists, and then they show footage of people who were killed an hour before this happened, and then they blame it on Chavez. They said that Chavez ordered these people to shoot and kill opposition demonstrators. So we have something that if I, when I was consul, one of the things that I had to do the most was to talk about the case of RCTV in Venezuela, a TV station that 4 years ago, the government denied the renewal of their license. And a lot of people say, well, Chavez is closing the media. Why? And I tell people, well, what would you think if Fox News invited some military generals in the U.S. Army who were demanding President Obama's resignation and were calling for a a popular uprising against the Obama administration, and they recorded the whole thing on Fox News Studios with the consent of, you know, the president of Fox News and all that, Fox News will be closed immediately. Chavez didn't close that station, but these people recorded this statement 2 hours before the events at the bridge happened, and they mentioned that the government had ordered people to be killed, and that it was Chavez's direct order to kill people. So actually, they were predicting, quote-unquote, what was going to happen 2 hours later. It was all part of a plan, a very well-crafted plan. So what were the people doing in order to prevent this? This is a thing that a lot of government officials in Venezuela, and I can speak very freely now that I'm not in the government, and I have, in particular, a friend who's still an ambassador. Who, it's embarrassing when we mention this, and every, you know, every April 11, April 13, you know, it's like the whole thing. I joke with him by email, like, hey, remember when you told people this? What happened is that the day after the coup, grassroots activists in Caracas meet at a place, and it's like, you know, 500 people meeting at a place because they're all concerned that, you know, a coup is coming, because they, at that time, on April 9th, the anti-government forces launched the strike, and then there were rumors that a coup was coming. And then the government were telling activists, don't bother with mobilizing. We have everything under control. The military is on our side. You need to go home. That's what happened on the morning of April 11th at 4 a.m. after the meetings of the previous night. The group decides to write a flyer, which is that flyer that's on the left. They say, well, how are we going to sign this flyer? This is just, you know, a bunch of people here. And they pick a name. Someone just pick a name, Popular Revolutionary Assembly, mimicking what was happening in Argentina the year before, in which there was a rebellion of, you know, middle-class people, and they called Popular Revolutionary Assemblies, you know, just neighbors meeting to plan, you know, attacking the banks and all that. So they copy that name. So, and they say, well, let's put it in the flyer. And they printed 100,000 flyers and went throughout the city to, you know, outside subway stations and, you know, everywhere to deliver that flyer. So that the people went that day, that morning, to the presidential palace to demand support from the government. They said, look, we need megaphones. We need, you know, in order to make phone calls, cell phone calls. In Venezuela, cell phones are so expensive that, you know. So they demanded, like, you know, prepaid cards for the cell phones and, you know, support from the government, basically. They said, we need to protect the government, to attack, because that day there was a march that the opposition has called for. And they said that they thought that the march could be, you know, sent to the presidential palace. So, and the government said, and this government official told him, look, we have everything under control. We have stuff that we can give you, but you don't need to. You just go home. If you are out on the streets, that actually provokes the opposition and makes them more angry. So it was a ridiculous thing to say to people. But that was how ill-informed the government was. And one of the things that I heard recently was that there was a one of the activists managed to get a hold of a high-ranking government official, which I will not name, but this person told this activist to tell his group to talk to a military commander in the army, because he's the guy in head of he's the head of security. Actually, this guy actually was one of the head of the coup. So it's one of the things that the government was completely infiltrated by the coup plotters. If you look at the way that, for instance, the radios, the government military radios work, they had unencrypted communications. So you had media outlets and, you know, people with CVs recording what the government was. Of course, they were talking in codes, but, you know, you could deduct, what, you know, guess what they were talking about. So that's why it was militarily so easy for the coup plotters to have, of course, the media on one side, the massive mobilization that they managed to pull out, and on the other side, you know, control of high-ranking officers in the military. So, but
The people, of course, you know, they mobilized, they convoked people, they brought people to the to downtown Caracas, where the presidential palace is, to low power FM stations and low power TV stations. They managed to tell people at that time, because all the private media were, you know, against the government and broadcasting anti-government messages. The only way that people could get an alternative view was to either read flyers that people would put out or turn, you know, their dial to low-power FM stations, which before that nobody listened to. Because, you know, it's like, why would you listen to a low-power FM station if, you know, there's nothing there? They're just, you know, broadcasting crappy, you know, things. I mean, the quality was really bad. But at that time, it was there was a need to turn to alternative media in order to really be informed about what was going on. So we have, for instance, in the south section of Caracas, the main media outlet was Radio Perola. These people, the director of this station, was immediately detained the morning of April 12th. There was a massive hunt. You see how the police immediately switched sides from supposedly defending the elected president to defending the new dictator, Pedro Carmona. And they immediately, you know, the police is a repression tool by the state. They immediately turn against, you know, they do whatever their masters say. And at that time, the master was, you know, the head of the Chamber of Commerce, who became dictator for 2 days. So they went, you know, there was a massive repression. I remember the stories of people who didn't even want to answer the phone, because they said, look, you know, if I answer the phone, then they might track me where I am. And, you know, we're all, you know, hiding. But on April 13, I think by that time already people have become informed again by alternative media that Chavez hadn't really resigned, and that the resignation letter that the coup plotters supposedly put out was fake, and Chavez had actually put a statement in which he said, I haven't resigned, and he signed it, and he smuggled it out of the jail where he was staying. And so this letter was printed in flyers, and people, mostly motorcycles, went with packs of flyers to neighborhoods, you know, giving away this letter that Chavez had written. So we had no TV station, well, only the low power FM stations, which were shut down by April 12th in the evening. And so people would try to, you know, the only way would be by flyers. Nowadays, people have Facebook, Twitter, and all that other stuff, which makes possible a lot of, you know, the Arab Spring. But back then, you know, we didn't even have a website that covered progressive news. So that group that was created in the night of April 10, during that meeting, it became a formal group, and they kept meeting after the coup d'etat, after the coup was defeated. As you saw in the revolution, when nobody televised, millions of people took to the street and managed to turn the tide and force the resignation of the dictator. So the group kept meeting, and other groups around the country kept meeting. And I immediately saw a need for, you know, look, the main problem that the grassroots groups have in Venezuela is that there's no way to tell your stories. I mean, there's so many things that could be told. And, you know, the two Irish filmmakers who were by chance at the presidential palace the day of the coup, they managed to get all this footage. But, you know, we needed a more sustainable and permanent way of telling our stories. So that's why I created the website for the group, just to post, you know, whatever resolution the group would say and would have and where they were going to meet and all that. And but all of a sudden, people started sending reports of what's going on there in the neighborhoods, that they heard, like, some opposition people are planning again another coup. And it's like, well, is that true? Or, well, let's post it. And then some people sent opinion articles about what I think, you know, we should do, because the government is incompetent. They cannot fight the coup plotters. We need to do this. So, okay, well, let's post this third-party statement too. So then people forced this website to become a media outlet, because there was so much need to tell, to say something. And so yeah, then the group in 3 months later stopped meeting, because you know, the new coup didn't happen. And but the website remained. And then it turns out that in December of that year, there was another coup attempt in the form of a sabotage of the oil company. Venezuela gets about 70 or 80% of its revenue income through exports of oil. So if you hit the oil company, then you hit, you know, the nerve of the government and the main source of income. So that way, you know, they figured that they could really topple Chavez. So the site becomes the only way that nationwide, because you have low power FM stations, low power TV stations who broadcast locally, and they cover a few blocks, you know, 20, 30 blocks, but there's no way for, you know, a nationwide audience to communicate. So this website became that. And the good thing is that when people posted, you know, successful, they mobilized against the opposition in such and such neighborhood, and they took pictures of how the opposition had to run. And so they posted that in the website. That inspired other people in other places. That's the magic of having a media outlet that can reach everyone and not just locally. So it became really, you know, one of the main media outlets for the grassroots movement. I remember in December, it's ironic, you know, December 28th, in the Hispanic world, people pay a lot of, like, April Fool's jokes on people on December 28th. They call it Innocence Day. So you play jokes on people. So I got a bill for $3,500 from the web hosting company, and when you try to log on to a website, it says this account has been suspended because of lack of payment. The sheer amount of visits, the site was not designed for, you know, it was designed for like maybe 200 visits a day or 500, not for 10,000 or 20,000. So the bandwidth that the site consumed was so huge that they suspended the account and they sent me the bill. And I call my friends in Venezuela, look, my friend, I cannot pay this. This is $3,000. So don't worry, we'll talk to the vice president. Well, what do you mean you're going to talk to the vice president? Who cares? I mean, I had no idea that it was that important. And yeah, like 20 minutes later, I got a call from some lady. This is the secretary of the vice president of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Are you Martin Sanchez? Yes. We need the information to make a payment that needs to be made. I was like, wow. So they save us, because otherwise I wasn't going to pay that $3,000 bill. So anyway, the site, you know, half an hour later, the site was up again. And so it was such a pivotal moment for the government, because they realized that alternative media could really, you know, become a tool for democracy. If you look at the project that Chavez tried to, his platform to, when he ran for president the first time, was to reform the constitution in order to create a participatory democracy, so that we go beyond representation, beyond electing someone. We need people to participate in the daily affairs of their lives. Alternative media is one of those things that power this type of democracy. So the government had experimented with several ways of promoting participatory democracy. We have the councils of local planning, mimic after, what's the city in Brazil where they started that stuff? Porto Alegre, yes. We tried that. It became infiltrated by the mayors and the city council people who, you know. Anyway, so we created then the communal councils, which, you know, are somewhat successful nowadays. And one of the ways that the communal councils tell their stories is with their local newspaper, the local and through the local low-power FM station. So the government has actually, up until now, have given away up to 3,000 low-power FM antennas and broadcasting equipment. And the same with the several tens of TV broadcasting equipment. So we have, at that time, you know, the government realized that, of course, they couldn't, you know, compete. We had only one station. The private media was all against the government. They covered 95% of the audience. And so alternative media was a way to try to, you know, tell the other side of the story. And that was something that came from below. It wasn't like, you know, the government didn't create it. The government fomented it and later, you know, in my case, you know, save us from those huge bills. And so we have, of course, nowadays, massive support from the government for alternative media. In the case of my site, we have 100,000 daily visits. You know, it goes up to 600,000 when there's an election or a big event. And later, a year after I created that Aporrea site, I collaborated with a friend of mine named Greg Wilper, and we created Venezuela Analysis because, as you know, there was a huge void in the English language coverage of Venezuela. So we created this project. And one of the other things that the government had done is that they had given a legal framework for this alternative media outlets, not only giving away the equipment, but actually legalizing the spectrum. So, you know, such and such FM, you know, popular, you know, barrio, you know, FM station gets actually a legal paper in which they've been granted a license for 10 or 20 years for that, you know, that spectrum to cover, you know, how many miles and so on. So it's legalized. It's fully legal. It's not like, you know, they were back during the coup days, they were, you know, clandestine. They were illegal. Like it happens here. You know, I hear every month I hear the FCC shut down such and such station in Idaho or whatever. Or, you know, I don't know how they call it, like pirate radio station. So the government in Venezuela actually have legalized that, which, you know, in many cases, like for instance, people who from the 1930s have gone into the cities and have built houses in public land. The Chavez government had been the first government that actually have given a title to those people, to that land. So when you talk about Chavez being against private property, well, hello, actually there are more people now who own private property. I mean, their houses, their cars, their washing machines, their private property. Now, talking about means of production is another thing. So, but, you know, anti-communists would scare people by saying, look, socialists and communists want to take away your underwear and everything will become public. So it's not like that. So, you know, right now the government has have been pressured by the National Association of Alternative Media in Venezuela and other groups. We have internal fights, and, you know, so we have three national associations for alternative media because we have disagreements with each other. But there's one thing that we all agree was that there's no way to coordinate all these scattered efforts. You have, for instance, the Aporrea site. It's something that posts, you know, content from many other alternative media outlets, but it's not like a formal clearinghouse for all this stuff. And when we have fights with this tendency or this group, then we don't post their stuff because, you know, they said that we are this and that. And so we need a more transparent thing, you know, to actually post everybody's stuff. And so they, 2 days ago, they created a national clearinghouse for alternative media that will, you know, it's like the first step to become a full information agency that's, you know, in the hands of the people. So we hope that something like this can really play a role in the battles ahead that we have. We have, you know, the relationship with the government is not always easy because, I mean, very often alternative media outlets are critical of the government, and that's something that a lot of people sometimes call me or email me and saying, how could you guys post this? Don't you know that the right-wingers are going to use this against Chavez? Well, my friend, but, you know, we had to clean up our house too. You can't allow this kind of stuff happen. Yeah, but that's irresponsible. Well, anyway. So, you know, the good thing is that all the sites remain independent. You know, the government, many government institutions actually put publicity in our sites and in many popular newspapers and low-power FM stations and TV stations, but they don't put conditions on what gets posted. So I know very well the Minister of Cultural Affairs, and they have a, you know, a little, you know, ad in our website, and often, you know, we have all these people, artists, you know, criticizing the minister, and well, he's forced to write a response, you know, against that criticism. So he knows, you know, but other government officials become more sensitive to criticism. But one thing is that we don't really take down stuff because, you know, such and such person said something. So Anyway, I'll leave it there because, you know, I'm sure that you all have a lot of questions. I, you know, hope that I cover a lot of the, you know, what I wanted to cover. So thank you.
Thank you, Ken and Martin, for your words. I believe that they are important for the people that do not know, do not have too much information about Venezuela and what happened in 2002. And I just want to open the session for questions and answers. So feel free to make your questions. I might start asking questions for Kim, just to break the, how do you say it in English?
Break the ice.
So the ice.
Else recording. Let me.
Okay. I just want to ask you if you have, like, updates on the AFL or another unions, you know, working in Venezuela.
Okay. No, there's not any, I don't have any more current information as far as what's going on today. This is something I need to, unfortunately, I got my hands on a lot of different things, so I haven't stayed up on this. It needs to be something I need to revisit. One of the interesting stories, though, that I probably should tell is that in 2004, a friend of mine that I work with, a man named Fred Hirsch, who is a plumber out in California, he's now retired. Fred was the man that exposed the AFL-CIO operations in Chile. Anyway, he got together with some people and passed a resolution through the California State AFL-CIO. In most states where there's a large number of unions, they have a statewide organization. And he got the California State AFL-CIO, which at that time had about a sixth of the entire AFL-CIO national membership, and they unanimously condemned the foreign policy program of the national AFL-CIO. And this was a major step because this moved it from a few of us that were being sort of like gadflies to where a major organization had supported us. And that resolution went to the national AFL-CIO convention of 2005, which was held here in Chicago down at Navy Pier. And when it went before the body, it had been changed not to condemn the AFL-CIO operations, but to praise them, to praise the Solidarity Center's operations around the world. They let some people get up and speak on the body of the floor praising their work, and when folks got up to support the California resolution, they cut off all discussion. So what we see, why this is important to relate, is that not only, I mean, these operations have hurt workers around the world, particularly in the developing countries, but how they've maintained it and why it's important for us, in addition to supporting workers around the world, is that we've got to change this foreign policy stuff here at home because it's affecting American workers as well. It's hurting our democracy as well. We're not just screwing over workers overseas. We're doing that, and we're screwing over workers here. So that's an important thing. But this is an ongoing thing. There's quite a controversy within the AFL-CIO about this stuff. But what's really interesting is I bring this book out, and the book is very, very carefully documented. Nobody will talk about it. I've even sent it to the president of the AFL-CIO himself. I sent him a personal copy. I've gotten no response. Nobody wants to talk about it. Unfortunately, not even a lot of activists in the labor movement. So it's an ongoing thing. So what we have to do is have to get the word out person by person, union by union, because this is a struggle important not only for our democracy here, not only for workers around the world, but our democracy here. Okay. Any other questions for Martino or myself? Yes, sir.
Yeah, he asked about the role of the Spanish government in the coup. Back then, in 2002, the Spanish government was in the hands of the PP, the ultra-right-wing party in Spain. And the other question was about why media outlet Telesur doesn't have an English language, newscast. I would leave probably the second question to a government official, a government bureaucrat, consul general here. But the first question regarding the Spanish government, you see how, for instance, on April 12th, the day after the coup, there were two ambassadors who visited the newly self-appointed dictator. the U.S. ambassador and the Spanish ambassador. So there you have the main two, you know, foreign entities influencing the dictator. And now, then later they claim that they went to talk to the guy so that he wouldn't dissolve the Congress and fire all elected officials and all that. It's just basically, no, we went to calm him down because he was too up, you know. So anyway, so that's the best evidence that you have the role of the Spanish government. We don't have, for instance, there are recordings of the head, the chief of police, the Metropolitan Police in Caracas, talking to the U.S. ambassador by telephone or by radio. So why would an ambassador be talking to the chief of police at that day, one of the, you know, main drivers of the coup? So, but the Spanish government, we don't have concrete evidence or recordings of anything, but the fact that the ambassador of the, of course, the Aznar, the José María Aznar government, was the president of Spain at that time, was highly critical of Chávez, and the media that's friendly to the PP in Spain, in particular the main newspaper, El País, is a very anti-Chávez media outlet, and they did play a role in mobilizing the Venezuelans who live in Spain to, you know, become anti-Chávez people. They highlighted, you know, bad stuff that's going on in Venezuela. They didn't say any good things about it. So, you know, of course, the media and their partners in crime, in government, high in government, you know, are always teaming up against, you know, any efforts to threaten their interests. So, Telesur, why isn't there an English language Telesur?
Internal information that the one that I might have, but I basically understand. I believe that they have been trying to move steady but slowly into the direction of your question. I believe that they might try to do it faster, but at least they Telesur have right now apps for smartphones and tablets and things like that, so you can see right now using your cell phone or your tablet their online signal and their news and video coverage and those things. I hear from someone, that's not an official information, or I read it somewhere, that that they has been working in like creating like a division in English or something like that, but I believe that it's going too slow, but I also hope that one day they're going to have like Al Jazeera, how do you say it in English? An English edition, broadcast. Something like that.
Well, that was the government line. Now hear the truth. my opinion is that by judging by the reaction that we had when I created Venezuela Analysis, is that the government in Venezuela doesn't see much of a need to, or see it as a very hard task to change public opinion in the U.S. And an English language broadcast of Telesur would be mostly aimed at audiences in the U.S. And I see that that's not in the radar of the government right now. The way they approach relations with the U.S., it's somewhat frustrating, I would say. You know, when I work in the foreign ministry, you know, there were a lot of proposals that were made that were not, you know, and attempts to explain the reality in the U.S. For instance, I always tell when I go to Venezuela and people say, the U.S. labor movement, it's rubbish. They don't do anything. It's like, do you really know the laws they have here against unions and how they turn unions into basically paperwork stuff? I mean, 80% of a union has to do paperwork, basically, you know. I mean, and then you go on strike and they limit the picket line. And you ask, why do the gringos just walk in circles with the little signs? Like, oh, they're stupid. Yeah, you're gonna topple that company. Well, it's not like that. It's not like they want to do that. It's like they're forced to by law. Otherwise, they go to jail. So they had to bring other people, like students. When I was student in college here, I used to go to union strikes, and we as students could get away with things that the union workers could not do. So that's why they need solidarity from outside to, you know, circumvent the legal framework. So I would really, so there's a lack of understanding in Venezuela of the realities to the U.S. and the possibilities that there are here in order to change public opinion and to change the tide. And the way, unfortunately, the way they see it down there is that, you know, if Chavez is not friends with the U.S. president, then, you know, things down below are not going to happen, you know. They don't see the U.S. as the big heterogeneous society that it is, and the possibilities of that there are. You know, I work. One of the things I work when I was consul is to try to promote sister city agreements, because that's a way to promote local cities with local cities in Venezuela, and you know, exchange culture and information and events and things like that. And I was successful when I was here in Chicago. We got Milwaukee and Madison, Wisconsin, to be sister cities with two cities in Venezuela. But when I went to San Francisco and, you know, our ambassador was kicked out of the U.S. and things went sour, a lot of people thought when Obama was elected, oh, things are going to change because he's a Democrat. The progressives are always good and all that. And it was the opposite. Things were got worse, actually. Obama probably didn't read that book that Chavez gave him 3 years ago. So, you know, we don't, Venezuelans don't understand the U.S. society, and the U.S. don't understand Venezuela either. So, you know, it's a challenge. That's why I work for a group in the Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area, where I live, called the Marine Task Force on the Americas, which is the group that sponsored Kim's trip to Venezuela. And we right now send a delegation of 12 people to Venezuela who are right now in Venezuela, you know, traveling and meeting with grassroots activists. And that's how, you know, from below we try to do that, you know, send delegations there for people to see with their own eyes their realities. Because I remember last year, 2 years ago, I had a lady from the foreign ministry who went to San Francisco to evaluate or install some stuff at the consulate and checked some things that we were doing. And I had that lady over in my house for dinner. And my wife is from the U.S. My wife is from Iowa, from the Midwest. And Midwest, you know, they're good with casseroles and things that are based in corn and stuff. And then my wife prepared this good meal for this Venezuelan lady, and she tasted this stuff, and she said, "This is the best thing in the world. How come you don't sell this stuff? And you're just selling hamburgers, McDonald's, and Burger King. This is real American food." I was like, "Yeah, well, this is real American food that people overseas don't know about." So you see someone comes here and get all impressed about what real American food. So it's, you know, unfortunately, the corporate media really present distorted views of both countries. And that's what I think alternative media is so important. I think what democracy now has done with the Spanish broadcast is so important, because after they had started having a Spanish news summary headlines, it become news automatically in the Spanish-speaking world. I mean, people get informed. The things that the Occupy movement have been doing in the U.S., really good coverage overseas, and then people scratch their heads. Wow, watch their gringos. I thought they were all concerned about materialism and convertibles and the latest, you know, what Paris Hilton or the Kardashian sisters are doing or something. And so people really, you know, they become more aware of what's going on here. So we really hope that this project that Telesur has, it's real, because there's a huge need in the U.S. to get information from Venezuela, from Latin America. Telesur covers all of Latin America from a progressive perspective, and we really hope that, like, the documentaries are amazing. You see, they get all independent documentary makers from Latin America who tell the realities about their countries, and, you know, you only see it on Telesur. It's the only source that really has. We tried to get Telesur when I was here in Chicago. We failed. We didn't get the sponsorship that we needed in order to have it on CAN TV. Is that CAN TV still called like that, CAN TV?
Yeah.
So anyway, but we failed. So anyway, I hope that the plans are successful, because we really need Telesur in English here in the U.S.
Just to follow up, what kind of sponsorship did you need in order to get Telesur on CAN TV?
Oh, he asked about what sponsorship do we need to get Telesur on CAN TV. I don't know. That was 5 years ago. I don't know what their requirements are now, but back then we couldn't find the funding, because they wanted to broadcast, I think, 1 hour of Telesur news in Spanish, because there's so many Spanish speaking people here in the Chicago land area that it would be worthwhile to have. I think the main radio broadcast in Chicago is in Spanish.
Hmm.
Piolini. There's a radio station here that's from La Ley radio station. So yeah, well, Hispanics pretty much have taken over here. You better watch out.
I'll just say before we ask other questions, as a representative of the dumb Anglo faction, please get Telesur here in English. Tell President Chavez next time you see him, we need it.
I understand. I forgot to say, but I forget also to say that, I mean, there is like a blockade from cable company to at least to present the Spanish-speaking version of Telesur. I mean, the government has been trying to do it, but and there is a blockade.
Very important. The Venezuelan government spent $2 million in lobbying Dish Network and DirecTV a few years ago to try to get Telesur in their channel lineup. There are a lot of Spanish language broadcasts on channels in DirecTV and Dish Network, and we just couldn't do it. Not in Comcast, didn't want to. You would ask, well, why would they allow Al Jazeera? Well, Al Jazeera got in before 9/11. So, yeah, well, the Arab network, okay, that's fine. Yeah, well, that was in the year 2000. If that had happened in 2002, they would probably not allow Al Jazeera. It would look really bad if they took Al Jazeera out of their lineup. So I think the strategy with Al Jazeera was actually to try to get them to be more corporate friendly. And they succeeded because Al Jazeera is not what it used to be, as you know.
Years ago, I was a Peace Corps volunteer for Venezuela, South America. One of the oldest Peace Corps volunteers you'll meet. I was in the 6th year of the Peace Corps in Venezuela. So I beat the Vietnam War, to tell you the truth.
Good for you.
The issue is that probably when I look back on it, it was one of the greatest things that I ever did in life is to live outside of America. I grew up in the South, in Memphis, Tennessee, in the apartheid system of America. Mm-hmm. Never dreamed I was going to college or anything, but got lucky and got a whole lot of education. But Martin, fast forwarding, he helped us take a group of black educators to Venezuela. I hadn't been there in 40 years, and so I decided I wanted to go back because while I was there, myself and another roommate, a white kid from Boston, Massachusetts, we were responsible for monies that built the schoolhouse there. And Martin and Omar, and they helped us plan this trip, so I took two or three attorneys from the south side of Chicago. I took minister who was at the time 94 years of age, and Will Evans is 98 years of age now, one of our most popular people on the south side of Chicago. Educators, vice presidents of this and that, and of course my wife, she's really the planner. And what we tried to do, because I've been hearing all of this negative information about Venezuela, and of course, if you know, being black and living on the south side of Chicago, too many people know anything about the Peace Corps or about the third world, and so as I would hear this information, I would share it with those of us, with my friends who I'd gone to law school with and others. And I said, you know, all this negative propaganda, I was probably treated better in Venezuela than I ever was in the South of Memphis, Tennessee. So we have continued to do that. My wife takes groups of teenagers from her school to Venezuela every other year. And so we're beginning to spread the word on the South Side of Chicago that that this propaganda, the propaganda that we've fed us, because believe me, the people were saying, why are you going to that communist country? Why are you going this? Why are you going there? But now, just in that little experience, in that trip, and it's just spread everywhere way up Evans go, and he's in charge of about 600 ministers. He's always talking about Martin and the experience that he had in Venezuela. So it's beginning to open eyes of black folks and African Americans on the south side of Chicago and throughout as I go. One other thing, Martin was responsible for us sending an African-American female who had lost her job here in the United States, driving a bus, and she didn't have insurance to take an exam, to pass the eye exam, and had an eye problem. And he hooked it up, along with Obama, flew her to Venezuela. She had an eye operation, and that lady's been working ever since she returned here. He gave us the money to take her back for a re-examination, so you're doing a good job, Martin. And he has a very good
boy, yeah, did we have a good time there in Venezuela, huh? I mean, this guy, when they went to the school that he helped build, that was like, you know, crazy, re-encountering and, you know, seeing all people that hadn't seen for like, what, 40, 50 years. and amazing. And we went to another all Afro-Venezuelan section of the country where my grandmother is from, and we visited the Martin Luther King School there. Chavez anti-American, and they, you know, created Martin Luther King School in the heart of Venezuela. So that's one of the things. It's so important to take people to see the realities. And what I would like to do is to also, you know, bring people from Venezuela to the U.S. to see what's really going on here. A lot of people who go, we managed to bring here. When I was in San Francisco, we brought, for instance, musicians, who were radical musicians, left-wing progressive, who were, you know, anti-corporate, and they had all this vision about the U.S. But when they come here and they see people like you, they say, wow, but this is not the U.S. that I see on TV. I read about it sometimes in alternative media, and then you hear Occupy this and the demonstration for, you know, immigrant rights here in Chicago, a million people and all that, and all those little flashes of things. Well, yeah, there are good things happening in the U.S. Well, they're not just flashes. They happen every day. And those are the stories that what we had to keep telling. And I learned from my friend Jesus today that program through which our friend had cataract surgery in Venezuela, Patty, we attempted at that time 5 years ago to create that to have this program here in Chicago so that we could take people in Chicago to take it to Venezuela for eye surgery for cataracts and. So it seems like they're going to revive the program. I hope the consul in the future will be able to make this big announcement, and, you know, we'll have this great thing going on, because there's a big need here in Chicago still. If you get in line at Cook County Hospital to have cataract surgery, you have to wait 2 years. 2 years, and you could have the surgery right away in Venezuela. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people from all over Latin America have gone to Venezuela to have free eye surgery. And the corporate media and corporations would say, well, why would you do this stuff for free with all people? You know, all people are not going to go back to their job market. They're not productive. They're all people. Well, because they treat people as statistics, and they say, well, if we cannot extract anything from you, then why are we going to spend money on you on eye surgery? So we in Venezuela see people as, you know, human resources. You know, we see the human side, and you see the stories, you know, people who, now the country, there's very little, almost zero illiteracy, because, you know, they enacted this massive literacy program. So, but when older people, like people who are 70, 80 years old, learned how to read and write, I mean, it's just magic. You hear the testimonies of these people. It's just, you know, a whole world. It's like they were born again because they can read. And they get all these books and they become obsessive about reading. It's like crazy. It's just, but you had to go there to see it with your own eyes and hear people crying of how they experience all this stuff. So, you know, yeah. I hope that you can go back to Venezuela, you know, in another delegation, and, you know, bring more people, team up with the consulate, and, you know, keep this ball rolling. We recently, right now, my group sent a delegation to Venezuela right now, and we keep insisting in trying to get, you know, sister city agreements with the city of Oakland. Unfortunately, your partners in Venezuela haven't responded, but we hope that, you know, that can happen, and we can, you know, keep this ball rolling and keep the hope alive. One thing about that TV station is that in the Spanish language version that they have, because they also have a Spanish language version, there's a TV show, an hour long show by one of my friends, Eva Gollinger, who wrote a book about the U.S. intervention in Venezuela to destabilize the government and all the funding from the National Endowment for Democracy, something that Kim mentioned during his talk. So lawyer Eva Gollinger has a weekly hour show. Right now it's been suspended because she just had a baby. But, you know, she'll go back to her old, ways of, you know, it's been very, very informative, especially for people outside of Venezuela who need information about what's going on. Unfortunately, for now, it's in Spanish. She will, you know, since she was born in the U.S., she speaks perfect English. She will be able to do it in English. So we hope that we can actually get it in the main English broadcast.
Yeah, no, it is the top leadership. It's been every one of the presidents of the AFL-CIO, well, going back to the AFL, the American Federation of Labor, under Sam Gompers. But it's very top-level people, you know, the president, probably the secretary, treasurer. Unfortunately, they don't want to talk to me for some reason. I can't understand why. But what we know is that top-level leaders, elected officers, some of the executive committee, they have a Department of International Affairs, they're all involved in it. The interesting question that it raises, though, is why? That's the big reason. And I think that this is where it becomes even more important, because first of all, I mean, I know we've all been taught that to understand the United States, we only have to look at the geographic United States, I mean, including Alaska and Hawaii, but still just the geographic United States. Folks, you know, and I've been studying this for the last 30 years. I'm a former sergeant in the Marine Corps that turned around during the Vietnam War. Fortunately, I never went over. But I've been studying U.S. foreign policy for 40 years. And one of the things that I'm absolutely certain on, and I think we as progressives have to take on, is that we cannot confine ourselves to just understanding the United States as a geographic country, that we've got to see ourselves as an empire, that there is a U.S. empire. It extends around the world, and basically U.S. foreign policy since at least the end of World War II has been to dominate the world. Okay. Now, once we look at that, then this allows us to have, one, a more complete understanding. But what it also does is it allows us to understand the role of militarism and the massive amounts of money that have gone into this. So, for example, I've done research that shows since 1981, we have spent over $10 trillion on just the military and the war machines. Okay. Now, this is $10 trillion that hasn't gone into healthcare. It hasn't gone into education. It hasn't gone into combating climate change. It hasn't gone into school grants. It hasn't gone into anything other than killing people and benefiting those folks like Boeing who live down in the loop. Excuse me. We can understand this. And I think the American people have to understand this, because what is happening right now is, you know, there's this big debate about our national debt. And our national debt is something that has exploded just in the last 30 years. Let me take a minute for this because this will tie in nicely. Every year the government has a budget. And at the end of the year, so they say, well, we need so much money to run our operations this year. And so they raise taxes that way, and at the end of the year, they either have a budget or a surplus. Now, by the way, we have only had 4 years of surplus since 1970. The rest of the years have been deficits. All right, but what the government does is every year they put that deficit or surplus together, and that is what's called the national debt. And that goes back, so we can tell how much money the U.S. government has overspent or underspent since 1789. Okay, so since 1789 up to 1980, so we're talking from George Washington to the end of Jimmy Carter's campaign, the U.S. government's national debt was under $1 trillion. It was $909 billion. All right, since 1981, Reagan comes into office as a fiscal conservative. In 8 years, the national debt goes from $0.9 trillion to $2.7 trillion in 8 years. So that whole earlier period, which covers the War of 1812, the Civil War, the Indian Wars, the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, on all of that, plus, say, like federalization for the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, things like this, that was less than $1 trillion. Today, it's over $15 trillion, and that's just grown in 30 years since Ronald Reagan. And it's happened under both the Democrats and the Republicans. Now, what the Republicans in particular are pushing today is we've got to reduce that deficit spending. Well, if you're digging yourself a hole, the first thing you do is stop. So if you're using military spending, which is driving this stuff, it would say cut the military spending. They don't want to do that. They want to cut our social programs, Medicare. They want to cut the education, things like this. This is why we've got to understand the U.S. as an empire, because we're trying to dominate the world at the very expense not only of people around the world, which is bad enough, but also for our people here. I mean, this is why we're cutting schools. We don't have money? Bull. we're just putting our money to build the military, to project the military, rather than taking care of our own people. And this is crucial, crucial stuff. So it's important that we demand that each other, as well as the country, recognizes this is a global empire. Because we can't understand what's going on in this country without putting it in that global context. It's absolutely essential. It's absolutely essential.
Yeah, I would add to that that also we need a class analysis of the nature of that empire. Because when you look at, for instance, the problem that we have in California right now in the Bay Area, the California government is building a new span of the Bay Bridge, you know, during the an earthquake. What was in 1989, part of the bridge fell down because it was very badly made. So there was always a need to build a stronger span of the bridge that links Treasure Island, an island in the center of the bay, to the Oakland coast. So they've been, you know, during the Schwarzenegger administration, they made the decision to commission the bridge. And it turns out that all the steel, all the components come from China. And then you say, why would they do this with so many metal workers in California who are unemployed? Not only in California, here in Chicago. Chicago is a steel town. Pittsburgh. I mean, so many people who are in need of work. And, you know, the economy is in need of economic stimulus. And they made the bridge in China. So there are already a lot of people mobilized asking why, you know. So you say, well, the local government will save a few million dollars by having the bridge made in China. Yes, when it comes to signing the bill, if you made it in the U.S., it will be higher. But if you act in the national interest, you would make it here. So these politicians and corporations, they don't have, at some sense they do when it comes to wars and, you know, geopolitical conflicts. When it comes to the profits, they're willing to team up with capitalists and foreign entities in detriment of their own workers here. And you would say, well, it would even benefit them locally in the U.S. if they help the economy keep going, because, you know, if people are unemployed, there's less TVs, less VCRs, less cars that they are buying. But they also think short term, and that's one of the problems that capitalism is having right now. The capitalists are thinking in the 2 or 3 year span. You know, and where I live in Silicon Valley, you know, you get funding for a project if you're going to build the next app for iPhones or tablets or iPad or whatever, because that's probably going to turn a profit within 1 or 2 years. But if you want to create a manufacturing company that, you know, you had to wait 5, 10 years in order to start producing some profits, you're not going to get any funding. So there, even within capitalism, there's this crisis. So I think that we, apart from seeing the empire and all the interests, we need to look at the issue of class. Because that's important to understanding why they do what they're doing in Venezuela and why. Like, for instance, you watch the revolution with Novi televised, you understand class immediately. I mean, you see how, you know, the dark-skinned poor people are with Chavez and, you know, the mostly white and the European looking people in Venezuela are against Chavez. And that's, you know, it's the support or opposition is drawn across class lines. So that's something that really needs to be understood. Of course, the issue of race is also extremely important. In the U.S., I think the Communist Party in the beginning of the 20th century made a mistake of saying, no, we just had to look at class. Race will not matter. If we abolish capitalism and slavery and all that, then, you know, immediately class will not matter anymore. Well, you know, in Cuba, people had the opportunity to, black people with the revolution had equal opportunity. For everything, for college, for jobs, for everything. And, you know, I think it was 11 years ago, Fidel Castro recognized that, you know, they totally ignore people of color. I mean, the issue of race. And then they had to go back and revisit the, you know, the need for, you know, take a race-based approach too. So we need to look at things, you know, with class and race too, in order to understand what's really going on, not only here, but, you know, in the world.
I just want to add to that, because he asked something about Telesur and the use of technologies and those things. We are aware of that, actually. I mean,
there's a lot of people that in Venezuela that are capable to use the technologies that are around to, you know, take it into our advantage. But sometimes for the bureaucracy, it's not easy to move on. And I believe that what Martin said was is also true, that some people in Venezuela underestimate the importance of sending a message to the U.S. So I believe that is a mix of that. And related to the your ALBA question, I'm not an expert on that, but I learned a lot of things from a conference that we organized like 3 weeks ago. And basically, I mean, ALBA is a concept on development. You cannot define it as the usual international integration schemes or things like that, but according to the information that we receive, it's something that is doing good things. For example, Nicaragua and Bolivia became free electricity-free territories after joining ALBA, and you can see like a lot of examples like that. And you have Petrocaribe, and you have Banco del Sur, and you have a set of institutions that has been created and are going to be creating in the future, which I believe are going to allow us in Latin America and South America to have more power for ourselves. So that's basically what I wanted to say.
There's a lot you said there that I agree with, but I also want to suggest we don't need to put it in dichotomous terms like that. It's not that we're bad, they're good, or Chavez is good, others are bad. Excuse me, that kind of thing. I think part of the thing for us in the United States is we have been trained to think dichotomously. It's something either or. I think we need to think of it differently, of saying it's both and. So, yes, they have made incredible advances in Venezuela. They still have a long way to go. I wish we were near as far as they were. There's no question. But it's not to just wave a flag and say it's class and therefore we know everything. Folks have been saying this for years. What I think is happening going on is that people, progressives all around the board, are trying to find ways to move us forward. Some are working on alternative media. Some, such as myself, are teaching. Others are working in South Chicago. Things like this. I don't think there's a simple answer for anybody. I think the issue is power. I absolutely agree with it. But I think it's going to be through women's struggles, through struggles of people of color, through working struggles. It's going to be a combination of things. But I think you're absolutely right. It's that we've got to change things, and we're the ones that have to make that decision. We can't wait. God, we can't wait for the Democrats. We'll be here for, you know, we'll all be dead before anything happens. And I don't even need to talk about the Republicans. But how do we form organization, our own organization? How do we organize our networks, our communities to do things? I think these are big things. So I don't want to look down at Occupy Chicago. I see their strengths. I see some of their weaknesses. That doesn't mean they're no good. I think, let's say, how can we push their strengths forward and reduce their weaknesses? How can we address these problems I've identified within the labor movement, and many others know many other problems? There's a whole bunch of them, unfortunately. But do we give up on the labor unions? I don't think so. I think we've got to find ways to struggle any way we can. I think the students need to struggle. I think it goes off almost anything that you want to do. This world is we're being killed, if you will. We're being killed literally by the change in the environment, but our day-to-day lives, you're right, things have gotten worse under Obama. But the question is not just to wave a flag or something, but to say, how can we build in our own neighborhoods, our own workplaces, wherever we are, to build for a society where we do make those changes, such as being exhibited, especially in the best cases, in Venezuela.
Two things I was going to say is that in Venezuela, the class struggle reflects itself also within the government and within the pro-Chavez forces. You have a lot of bourgeois company owners who claim to be Chavistas, and they exploit the workers, and then they go to a demonstration with a red beret. Yeah, I go Chavez. And it's outrageous. And I denounce these people And now that I'm not part of the government, I'll keep denouncing, because this is something that's really putting the brakes on the revolution. These are the people who are preventing a lot of the advances. When you talk about, for instance, the communal councils of Venezuela, groups of neighbors who meet every week to decide things that are going on in their neighborhood, to decide who will build the new sidewalk, who will do the new basketball court, who will do, what company will put the elevators in the building, and so on. In many cases, this great effort at participatory democracy is going very well. But in other cases, local alleged pro-Chavez corporate, you know, people are really derailing these efforts, because it's really by either hijacking these groups or by betting on their failures, they manage to keep their power, because, you know, they do get, their companies keep getting the contracts because of the good relations they might have with the mayor or with the city council, so they don't have to go to the neighborhoods to convince the people at the grassroots level to, you know, get the contract to their company. So this, you know, Venezuela is a capitalist society, and you go there and you see the contradictions of this thing. And how, you know, unfortunately, Chavez didn't start at the beginning. Maybe he wouldn't have won the elections if he had said that he was a socialist. So maybe what's happening is for the best. But people like me become kind of desperate, because sometimes we see that things are going too slow. And there's a lot of things that could be solved if we had a more, you know, a faster approach of moving faster in some things. It's not about, for instance, in the past, a lot of people said, well, Chavez hasn't expropriated any bank or any corporation. Well, now they have. And what happens in many cases, the companies that get expropriated, they become rubbish. They don't work. Some companies, like, for instance, there's a bank where my bank in Venezuela, Bank of Venezuela, it's called like that. It was expropriated from the Spaniards. And then all of a sudden, customer service went down, credit levels went down. I mean, everything became pretty much one of the worst banks in the country. Why is that? They put some bureaucrats at the top of these institutions, and they don't even go to the meetings. They don't make decisions. They don't sign the orders. So everything becomes low. So, you know, that initial, you know, drive that people had to make things better, it's stopped by, you know, bureaucracy and attempts to do things top down. So anyway, the other thing that I wanted to say was about here in the U.S., the labor movement needs to, I agree with what you said about the efforts by people. The important thing is that when you look at Venezuela as an example, you look at things, because a lot of people ask me, well, how can we do here in the U.S. what you guys did in Venezuela? I was like, well, you know, every country has its unique history and the possibilities for change. In Venezuela, what happened is that we had one person who, you know, agreed to be the leader of the movement, and there was pretty much a national consensus on the left to support this person. And this person, fortunately, has been true to its, for the most part, true to its promise. But the important thing is that there was a movement already on the ground before this guy came along. It's not like he just parachuted from the sky, and, you know, it is that the movement was built because there was already some foundations. So this Occupy Chicago, Occupy Oakland, Democracy Now, little efforts that people are making, you know, in the future can become pivotal for change. You just have to get the opportunity. What if there's a big economic crisis in the U.S., mass unemployment, laid off, and, you know, people, if you look at, for instance, the sympathy that the Occupy movement has generated around the U.S., I haven't seen that for years. I think only in the 90s with the UPS strike, we saw so much sympathy by people in the U.S. that was like, wow, so finally we can turn the tide, you know, from the air controller strike in the 80s where, you know, the union movement went south, and now so maybe other unions tried to do the same that the UPS workers tried to do, but they couldn't do it because they didn't have the muscle. They hadn't built their institutions. Unions have become, you know, malnourished in a sense. So the institutions were not there.
to really take this popular support, that sympathy that they were for unions. You know, part-time American won't work. That was the slogan, and it was successful, and big things were achieved. And you know, maybe, you know, I would see the demonstrations in Seattle against the WTO maybe as a continuation of that. But I didn't see much public sympathy after all this windows broken and all that. But I, you know, the lesson is that there has to be a movement on the ground ready, and there had to be people who are good journalists. Like, you know, Democracy Now might not be a big thing right now, might not have changed the tide for a lot of people, but it keeps the flame alive. And when things change, you know, if there's a movement on the ground, you know, things can really happen, like they happen in Venezuela.
I just wanna ask one more question, because we are already running out of time. From you, Neil, over there. But I just wanted to add to what they say as a bureaucrat here, that is true. I mean, you have good things here in the U.S. and things that are not right. And the same thing happened from what Martin says. I mean, we have good things in Venezuela, and we still have a lot of things that are not working very, very nicely. But I mean, we have to live with that. We have to, you know, live within those confrontations, within those realities. I mean,